This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay. I guess I'll do the welcome roll call SOI thing. I see Lorraine's on the call as well, but we're going to start with the findings on competition and consumer choice, so I will kick things off before handing them over to Lorraine in 45 minutes or so. Is there anyone who is on the phone who is not on Adobe Connect for roll call purposes?
Hi, this is Kylie Kine speaking, and I'm still on the way back home. I am on the phone and do not have Adobe Connect. But that will be
okay.
In about 20, 30 minutes.
Okay, thanks, Kylie. I just see you somehow on Adobe Connect. So in any case, thanks, we have you here. Anyone else on the phone? Oh, okay, great. So we do have quite a bit of background noise. I will ask folks that are connected and not speaking to mute whenever possible. And then my next question is, does anyone have any updates to their statement?
Update to what? Earlier today, I sent everybody an email, and I hope you have all received it.
Yeah, I at least received it. Thanks, Kylie. Okay, so just to give everyone a heads up in terms of agenda, we'll be talking through recommendations for both competition and consumer choice first, and then safeguards and trust, continuing our conversations from last week. Then we have a number of outstanding data requests, so we'll talk through those for a few minutes, including some prioritization. And then we have a brief conversation perhaps about the draft report that a group of us will be working on intensively next week. Any other agenda items anyone wants to make sure we address? Kylie, I think we won't have time to get to the discussion around parking today, but we'll talk with Jonathan about seeing if we can add that to following call, just because the agenda today is quite full already. Okay, great. So why don't we dive right in then to the competition and consumer choice document, which is currently being projected in Adobe Connect. This document is also a Google Doc, so to the extent that some of you want to follow along there rather than in Adobe Connect, that is fine as well. And if you give me 1 second, I will paste the link into the chat on Adobe Connect. John Baptiste has beaten me to it. So feel free to follow along in either place. If we have edits to the Google Doc, I'll make them in real time for those paying attention there. So I believe last time we were on the topic of parking when we wrapped up. Kylie has subsequently sent a rather long set of thoughts on parking, and right now our recommendation here is fairly soft, which is just to study some more. I think we are expecting more data here, and staff informed us this week that sounds like we've gotten things worked out with NTLD stats such that we'll be able to get some data on legacy TLD parking rates. So given all that, I'm going to push this parking discussion probably till our next, either to our next competition call if we have one or to our next plenary call, but we'll need to coordinate that with Jonathan a little bit, and then we can fully digest Kylie's document. In the meantime, I would encourage folks to pick up the conversation on parking based on Kylie's email. Email is probably a great place to engage with some of the points that Kylie raises. So, pushing that aside for the moment, I'm going to move on to the next section of the doc, which is, oh, so Waldo asks in the chat, when are we going to get the data on parking in Legacy? Waldo, I'm going to, let's just address that now since it's on point, but I don't see Eliza on the call yet, so we might not know the answer till she joins staff. Does anyone else from staff know the answer to that question?
I'm on call. I'm on the call.
Oh, you're hiding. You're one of the people that's on the phone, but not on Adobe Connect.
I am in the room. I don't know why I see myself in the room, but in any case, this is Eliza.
Oh, you're not a host.
Yes. I guess.
Yeah, sorry, Eliza. Yes, you're in the participant section.
Okay. So on the
now you're a host. All right.
So the question was, when are we collecting the parking data on from the legacy TLDs? I have reached out to NTLD staff. I've sent them a contract that has the terms that we agreed upon. I haven't actually received it back from them. My assumption is that everything will be fine. They had told me some time ago that it would take them a few weeks to pull this together. My guess is maybe 4 to 6 weeks after they sign the contract, we could receive it. But I don't know if their timelines have changed because it's been quite a while since we've begun this discussion. So I will let you know as soon as I know and as soon as I hear back from them.
So unfortunately, it sounds like the answer is probably not before we have to issue a draft report if that's coming out by the end of the year.
It seems unlikely.
Right, so we'll have to figure out how to deal with this topic in the draft report without that data. And it may be that there's some proxies we can use from some of the other studies. So this is something I think we'll want to address in probably the next plenary call, just how we deal with the topic, given that we'll be missing some important data. That's true for other important topics as well, such as DNS abuse and trademark costs. So I think there will just be a few places in the report with significant placeholders. But thanks for the update, Eliza.
Sure.
Okay, so moving on then to the next topic, or major topic here, which is the question of vertical integration, which is just flagged as a question. This is actually something I think we need to discuss a little bit more within the competition and consumer choice subteam. This has been flagged by an issue by the subsequent procedures PDP, but we don't have any findings here yet, and therefore we don't have any recommendations. So I'm just going to flag this once again as an issue that is going to require some further work on our part, and that we'll expect some more discussion within the sub-team. Okay, the next section here is on backends, and this relates quite a bit to the industry structure topic above, but focuses specifically on the backends component. I suspect we should probably rearrange this document, and in the final report, we'll start with the industry structure discussion and then segue to backends and registrars, since these are the two inputs to the industry structure that we discuss, and it'd be good to understand this aspect of the market. But so far, the only findings that we've documented here is that the market for backend services is unconcentrated when we look at the definition provided by the Department, U.S. Department of Justice uses, at least, with an HHI of 1284. It's also, once again, for new GTLDs, the market is much less concentrated than if we look at all gTLDs, largely because there's a single backend provider, VeriSign, which provides services to .com and .net, which are by far the largest gTLDs and largest, at least in the case of .com, by far the largest TLD in the world. So there's just one provider behind those two very large TLDs that ends up having a significant effect on concentration, whereas the new gTLDs are less concentrated, and as in the case of the general gTLD market findings, we see that as new gTLDs pick up increasing shares of the marketplace, that has an effect on decreasing overall concentration. So this just roughly matches the overall trend that we see on gTLD registrations. So I don't think there's a lot of new insights here. So as a result, we don't have any recommendations around backends in particular at this point. So I guess we'll pause and see if anyone has thoughts on should we be making any recommendations. This does seem like an area where we mostly have the data we need. I guess the one thing we don't have data on is the actual prices that backend services providers charge and whether that's changing over time. And Wodo asked, is there competition between backends? So Wodo, I'll answer in my personal capacity, which is, I think the answer is yes. I think I don't know if people are following, we could send it around, but PIR, which runs .org, is the registry operator for .org, recently did a RFP for backend services for .org, and there were over 20 applicants, I believe, or 20 interested parties interested in providing those services. So at least, you know, for a major TLD like .org, it seemed like there were quite a large amount of potential competition through that RFP process. And PIR says, at least publicly, that they were satisfied with the responses. So, so I guess the question is here, does anyone have suggestions? Do we think that there are recommendations that we ought to be making on this topic of backends? Okay. I'm not seeing anything, but Laureen is typing. Hopefully Laureen actually has working audio, since she's going to have to lead the second half of this call. But I'll wait one moment for the folks that are typing to complete before moving on to the next topic. Oh, Laureen just wants to be dialed back in, which will give her working audio, hopefully. Hopefully staff can take care of that. And separately, Wodo is typing. Okay, I'm not seeing any recommendations here. So I'm going to move on to the next section of the document, which is registrars. And I'm going to say to preface this that I've seen a little bit more data recently that makes me believe that these findings are perhaps a little bit oversimplified. And we may, as some of the follow-up work that we have here, end up expanding upon these findings. I also think Wodo sent around a document earlier today that we may want to discuss here as well. So we'll get to that in just a moment. But I will say that the current summary of the findings on registrars is that concentration amongst registrars within the new gTLDs has declined somewhat. Ooh, we have a little bit of echo there. Okay, it seems to be gone. Concentration amongst registrars has declined somewhat, largely because, once again, there's lower concentration within the new gTLDs. But generally speaking, there hasn't been significant changes in concentration amongst registrars because there was already fairly robust competition between registrars prior to the introduction of new GTLDs. So it looks like the new GTLDs have had a small positive effect on registrar competition, but it is small mostly because there was already robust competition here. And the other thing that we know, two other things we note here is first that although that there's sometimes high concentration within a specific TLD, so there might be a TLD where, say, a particular registrar has 70 or 80%, or you looked and calculated the HHI amongst registrars within that particular TLD, you'd get a high number. Even in those TLDs with high concentration, we still see a large number of registrars offering services. So it seems like consumers have choice, at least, even if a particular registrar or small set of registrars has a large fraction of the total registrations. And I think what we found, I think the analysis group report found it something odd, which was that these TLDs that had high concentration actually have lower prices. And so the concentration within specific TLDs doesn't seem to be having an adverse effect on pricing, which is probably worth adding to our findings if we can substantiate that. And then the last thing to note about registrars, I think, is a general observation that we've seen, which is even though it looks like there is robust competition, we still see very high variation amongst the prices between registrars for what we believe look like very similar-looking services. And this is an oddity that that we can't really explain, but is not what the economists expect, because there's this notion of the law of one price that in a competitive marketplace, the same product should all sort of gravitate towards the same price, which we don't see happening here. So that's an oddity. But I'm going to pause here because WODO sent around earlier today a paper on the pricing competition amongst registrars within registries. And I wanted to ask WODO if he had any additional findings from that paper that we wanted to incorporate into this document. So, WODO, I know you're on the call. Do you want to comment on your paper here? Is maybe assuming that we can get WODO's audio working because I don't hear him so far.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Great, WODO.
Hello? You can hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so the paper that I sent around, first of all, I just start off with a caveat that there was some information that we did not have. There was some analysis that we did not have at the last meeting in Hyderabad, and we asked the analysis group through that analysis for us, and we are still waiting for results from the analysis, and I've indicated there the information that we're waiting for. It includes calculation for each registry for the three price types, that is the selling price, the transfer price, and the third price is what? It's a renewal price. So those three prices, we need for each to be calculated the coefficient of variation and also the frequency of the coefficients. And that will give us some idea about whether the registrars are competing on price within the registries. So we don't yet have that information. However, the analysis group has earlier given us a special report for the CCT on registrar concentration. I think Jordan has already referred to that one. And that report, which I have also referenced here, indicates that there's quite robust competition within the registries in terms of the number of registrars that are within each registry. I don't know how significant that is. As Jordan has just said now, there was already quite good competition between registrars, even in the old legacy dates, so I don't know how significant that will be. But this report that was done by analysis group specially for our team indicates that for most of the registries, they exhibit quite a number of registrars. So the HHIs are quite low for most of the registries. I think conventionally that would indicate to us that there is some kind of competition going on just by the fact that each registry has quite a number of registrars. So I think that's what I can say about that particular project to date. We're still waiting for more detailed information from the analysis group, unfortunately. Thank you.
Thanks, Bodo. That's helpful. I do see in your document you do have a recommendation which I think aligns with a recommendation that we already have above in the other documents, which is that there's a mechanism explored to periodically collect retail prices by registrars for purchases, renewals, and transfers. So that's certainly something that we want to continue to include is that we probably need more pricing data in order to have future reviews be able to make good observations about pricing trends. So that makes sense to incorporate as well.
Yeah, that's a recommendation. Sorry, I left that one out.
Sure. Okay, thanks, Wodo. That's helpful. Does anyone have a question for Wodo about this document or his findings?
Is Stan on the call? I think he was helping out with this as well.
Yeah, I don't see Stan on the phone today, so I don't know if he'll be joining later or we can ask for his review offline as well. All right, so thanks, Wodo. I don't see any other questions here, so I'm going to move back to the findings. Oh, Kylie has raised his hand, so Kylie, go ahead. So far, we don't hear you, Kylie. Maybe unmute. Oh. Looks like we're trying to call out to Kylie. Let's see if we get a connection in just a moment. Okay. Looks like
hello. Now I'm no longer muted. I was just.
Okay. Calling. Yeah. Thank
you. You hear me now? Okay. Great. Okay.
Yes.
So anyway, regarding price competition, I fully agree that price competition is one probably most important aspect of competition on price. However, regarding the importance of price on, say, the domain names, I'm not sure if this is the best idea. Mostly because the price of the domain names, in the most cases, is only a small portion of the total overall cost to run a business over the internet or and other usages. So therefore, even if we do not reach conclusion on price competition, but still, this would not mean that this the new GTLD program is a failure. As a matter of fact, I believe the number one advantage or achievement of the new G program is that it provided much more choices, especially for brand names to have registrations in new GTLDs. So therefore, the
I think the price is an important aspect. However, it is not the only aspect of competition, and especially not for this new GTLD program. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, hello. Kylie. That's a good observation. And I think at this point, I think all we're capable of saying about price in our findings or recommendations is that in general, we have less data than we would like. I think you're right that separately, if we look at the registrant survey, there's a large number of factors other than price that registrants seem to care about. And so it's probably worth mentioning the fact that other factors will also be important to registrants, and that even though we want to get additional information on price, we shouldn't say that that's the only factor that would affect our assessment of the program.
Yes, so far our data is that so it's sort of inconclusive. But that doesn't matter. The new GE program has provided tens, over thousands of new choices for the registrants and the consumers. So that is great. I think that is the greatest achievement of new GE program. So even if we do not get the data to prove this price competition, or even if we get the data to prove the price was not lowered, still the new GE program has largely reached its goals.
Thanks, Kylie. That definitely touches on the consumer choice element of our study, which we'll definitely make sure to include. But that's a great option. I think Stan actually said a long time ago, early in our program, that in general, when we give consumers more choices, that's good, unless we find countervailing costs, sort of independent of the price topic. And so I think that may just be interesting. An observation that we want to make is that the choice itself is valuable.
As a matter of fact, in the classical economic literature, there is a market situation which is called monopolistic competition, which the end users or consumers, they give up some advantages of price. However, they gain are more choices. And I think this, for our DNS, especially the new G program, might well be the case according to the classical economic literature. And so this, as a matter of fact, nowadays in the world, that most commodities are monopolistic competition rather than full competition. So that is just good for consumers. That is what we want. They don't care that much about price. That's fine. So we don't need to worry about that much. Thank you.
Thanks, Kylie. That's a helpful observation. So we will make sure to include that line of reasoning. And maybe we want to include a specific section on choice in the findings, which we don't currently have.
Yeah.
So
yes, exactly.
That's a good observation.
That is the number one achievement of our new G program, choice.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks. That's a helpful observation, Kylie. And I'm going to suggest we jump back to the findings document, so if we can re-present that. We'll move. I'll give one last call. So Wodos presented his recommendations. We have another data request, but that's already mirrored in the GTLD market recommendations above. Based on these findings about registrars, does anyone have any suggested recommendations relating to registrars that we think we should incorporate into the report? Okay. Not seeing
I would suggest
go ahead.
Yeah. I would suggest that in addition to the price analysis, we also include just what I mentioned about monopolistic competition model in which consumers prefer to give a price advantage in exchange of choices. And that fully falls into all sub-teams territory. Thank you.
Yeah, that's right, Kylie. I think we'll resolve that by creating a new section in this doc on choice to break it out from these existing sections. So, agreed. Okay, I'm going to move on to the trademark section of the document. So just to remind folks, we've talked about this quite a bit already, but I guess there's, I'd say, two things about our findings on trademarks so far. The first is that most of our analysis here is limited to direct defensive registration costs. There's other costs that trademark holders could bear. One striking example is related to blocking. A number of registries provide blocking services, and I think we saw a series of articles to the lists recently indicating that Donuts, for example, is expanding their blocking service. And so we're not capturing the costs of blocking in any of the analysis we're doing so far. Secondly, there may be other types of costs related to enforcement, for example, that we're also not capturing here. I think David Taylor's done some initial analysis on costs related to UDRP and URS cases, and those don't seem to show an increase as a result of the program. But what we are expecting is that INTA is putting out a survey to its members asking them to help us understand, to help INTA understand, but we'll use the data as well, what the costs related to the new GTLD program were for those INTA members, which are intellectual property or mark holders. And that data will help us understand better some of these other costs. So with that caveat, I'm saying that there's still additional data that we're expecting here. What we see so far is something of a bimodal distribution in that most trademarks, so we definitely do see defensive registration costs in the new GTLDs. As with previous expansions of the TLD space, some mark holders who already have their name registered in COM or another legacy GTLD are choosing to register that same mark in additional new GTLDs. And the registrant survey tells us that that mark defense or brand defense is a significant contributing factor or a significant motivation for some of those registrants in registering their name. So we know that there is defensive registration occurring. It's not necessarily the case that all of the duplicate registrations where a registrant already has their mark registered in a legacy GTLD is registered in a new GTLD. Those might not always be defensive. I know Amazon, for example, Amazon.plumbing points to their plumbing supply store, so maybe they are actually using that as a way to better target some of their retail offerings, for example. There may be other registrants that are doing similar things where they have a purpose behind registering in specific second-level domains. And in fact, what we see is about half of trademarks that were registered in .com are also registered in the new GTLDs. And most of the registrants in the new GTLDs are registering only a small number of times. So if you have most of the trademarks are, I think the median number of registrations is only three. So 50% of the people that have trademarks that are registering in new GTLDs are registering three or less, or fewer. So I think we got Kylie back. We're getting quite a bit of background noise. So, Kylie, if you can mute, that would be helpful. Thank you. So, in any case, most, about half of trademarks in .com don't register in the new GTLDs at all, and of those that do register, most of them don't register in very many of the new GTLDs. However, we see a very small portion of the trademark holders registering very large numbers of duplicate registrations in the new GTLDs. 4% of the trademarks that we see registered in the new GTLDs are registered at least 100 times, and one trademark was registered in 406 of the new GTLDs, which is probably close, which is essentially all of them, I would say, based on the study that we saw. And so those trademark holders are probably bearing quite a bit of cost related to their marks. So that's the general finding, is that the cost of the summary that's written here is the cost of the new GTLD program for most trademark holders related to direct registrations and defensive registrations has been relatively low, but a small fraction of trademark holders are likely incurring significant costs. So that's the finding, at least. I see Kylie has his hand up. So, Kylie, go ahead.
Well, regarding the trademark registration, you can hear me? Hello? Regarding the trademark registration, first of all, ICANN is a nonprofit, and we are providing service to all the registrants through registries and registrars. And therefore, first of all, because the ICANN is not to make money, it's only to serve. In that sense, I believe a side effect, which I believe is unwanted, the multiple registrations in many cases we call that sports registration, and in order to avoid being hijacked by people of bad purposes. Okay. So therefore, also as far as we find so far, trademark registrations have nobody anyway, and the only benefit and help to protect trademarks. Therefore, as we formulate the recommendation, I highly recommend that we think this very possible solution is that if we have the next round, then we open up the door wide for the trademark holders. $185,000 is certainly too much. Because we are not here to make money. So therefore, as long as the trademark can be verified by publicly, by some authoritative entity, then we can provide a deep discount. For example, 90% off $185,000. And then also once a trademark is registered as a GTLD, then we provide some protection mechanism for those types of streams to be registered again in the second level domain name. And this, I think, I believe, would be much welcomed by the business community of the community. And also, we resolve a problem that at least I have heard a lot of complaints about. So I strongly suggest that our team discuss and provide some recommendations on this in order to avoid any drawback in our next round if we have it.
Okay, thanks, Kylie. I think I'll just note again, one interesting thing, we asked analysis group to do follow-up study or analysis of the data, and it looked like TLDs that were registered as DUP brands were also being registered defensively in many of the second-level domains. So it doesn't seem like the having the brand TLD itself is helpful to avoid defensive registrations. I think there's a separate question of do we provide some sort of blocking mechanism at the second level? And I think we, as we discussed on our previous discussion around this, it's hard to figure out what the right threshold is there, although this has been discussed. I mean, my takeaway is that because of this bimodal distribution we see, to the extent we have recommendations, they probably should focus on the small fraction of brands that are bearing most of the cost. But I don't think we've yet heard a specific recommendation that would capture that. Yeah, go ahead, Kylie.
Yeah.
And then I've got David in the queue.
Jordan, first of all, I agree with you that so far it's only a small number of brand name owners have registered over hundreds of second level domain names. However, that does not mean those brand name owners who cannot afford such a large scale registration that they would not like to do that. I see it. There are some internationally recognized brand name recognition entities or authoritative entities. If that is the case, then why I suggest we do provide some single level registration protection mechanism, for example, like that. And this, of course, I suggest that we provide some recommendation order to solve or at least partly solve this issue to open the door for our next round and to avoid any such drawback and to be more welcomed by the business constituents. And I think that's good for the registrants, good for the brand name owners, and good for the trust embedded in ICANN. And also that at least if we do not have time to fully study and formulate the policy in our current state, at least in our report, we raise this issue and we command ICANN for further studies of that. And I think in that case, at least we have not wasted our effort for taking time and energy on looking at this issue and then pave the way not only for further policies as well, but also as well as open the door with the list fewer drawbacks for the future rounds. So that is what I recommend. That is, if we do not have time to fully study and make policy recommendations, at least we raise this question for ICANN's further study.
Thanks, Kylie. I'm going to just, David may have something to say about this, so I'm just going to hand the mic to David, who's been patiently waiting in the queue.
Thanks, Jordan. Can you hear me okay?
Yep,
good, okay. Yeah, thanks. I suppose just looking at this, the worry I have is sort of the conclusion where we conclude from the data relatively low and the small fraction, so those two terms. I know we're talking just about defensive registrations, and I agree completely with your caveat that we may have other costs, and I no doubt do have the other costs on enforcement and watching, et cetera, which are out of this, and as well as the blocking. So when we look at the overall picture, it may be a different picture. But when we discussed, I think that the point I raised in Hyderabad was where we mentioned, I think three was the average registrations by brands according to this data. And I said, yes, certainly three seems relatively low, but relative to what? And there was the sort of concern I have if there's, you know, if we're looking at some big brands, you know, have thousands of domain names. Absolutely, three is incredibly minute. But we do have, I mean, I have clients who have three domain name registrations to their, that is the only domain name registration they have, a .com, a .net, and a .fr, for instance. Now, if they've gone and registered three new GTLDs, then their registration, defense registration budget has just doubled or gone up to 100%. So I'm sure they would be saying, well, it's not, for them, relatively small. For them, it's an enormous change. In the scheme of things, it's small because it's only three. But I just, that's the kind of thing where I'm thinking we need to be a little bit careful what we say on that. You know, maybe we need to, and this is perhaps the data we'll get from ITA, but you know, I'm thinking here out loud that we need to know the sort of the number of domains a particular brand has registered, say, over a period of time, and its evolution year on year, and then see whether they're actually registering more on an annual basis since new GTLDs have existed or not, and somehow have that sort of data so we get a proper overview, because I'm just a little bit concerned there that the conclusion is the right conclusion on the data we have, but we might not have the right data at all. And so my point on three and three being 100%, I think, is what I raised in Hyderabad, and I think that's something we need to be careful on.
Yeah, so David, it's Jordan. I guess, a couple of quick reactions. And I know that we're basically, we're close to out of time. I'm going to make sure that we hand over the floor to Laureen no later than at the top of the hour. So we've just got a few more minutes, so we may not fully be able to close out this conversation. But I guess I'd have two thoughts for you, David. The first is, while I expect you're probably correct that for some registrar, this has doubled the, you know, like you say, it is possible that we've actually doubled the sort of number of defensive registrations taking place globally. And that's all, in my opinion, defensive registrations are, you know, they're not helpful, right? They're dead weight cost to the system. So they're definitely a cost as opposed to a benefit.
Absolutely,
when we look
yeah.
at the pros and cons of the program. But nonetheless, if you looked, even if someone started and they said, oh, I used to have three and now I have six, the absolute cost to that trademark holder is still probably on the order of, you know, we're talking an incremental cost of, you know, tens or maybe hundreds of dollars per year. And when I look at that in the context of the overall cost to maintain their brand and their mark, that still seems relatively insignificant to me. And so I also, I guess the question, my notion, David, was when I look at this data, what it tells me is that our recommendation, and maybe this builds a little on what Kylie was saying, our recommendation should be along the lines of that, you know, future policy discussions around the, you know, trademark protections probably ought to focus on this long, and that's not really the long tail, on this tail of trademark holders that are incurring the majority of the cost, the significant majority of the cost, right? Like, this one registrant who's registering 406 copies of their SLD is bearing the cost of 100 plus of sort of the typical registrant registering three of these. And so it would make sense to me, at least, that if there was going to be future policy work in this area, it would focus on this these registrants that are bearing the brunt of the cost, as opposed to trying to do something that's really broadly tailored to try to get to the people that are, you know, minimizing the cost for the folks that are registering three. Because I think in terms of both the direct cost of those individual registrants and the absolute cost of the program, most of it seems to be landing on a small number of trademark holders. So I guess I'm wondering whether you look at the data and come to a different conclusion than that, and how the finding here, how crafting the finding one way or the other would sort of shape our recommendations.
Yeah, no, thanks. And I certainly appreciate that, looking at it that way. And I suppose it really just depends on, it depends on the data. So, I mean, I'll have a look at this in a little bit more detail. I've been concentrating on the enforcement side of things and see what we can, you know, come up with, because obviously certain brands will go defensive, certain brands will watch, certain brands will enforce. So we only look at a snapshot in this way of what their total costs may be. And again, we just don't know how many brands are out there. And again, the relative portion of this to their to their brand protection, you know, online generally. So it's the big picture. And obviously, we've got like this. It's like a jigsaw, and we're looking at one little element of it. And I just don't want us to make the wrong conclusion or the wrong takeaway when we don't have necessarily all of the data. But we've got, you know, let's work on it. No problem.
Yeah, agreed, David. I mean, we may find that we see totally disparate, like if we drew a Venn diagram, you know, we may see that like direct costs are totally discrete from enforcement costs. Like if you actually do all your defensive registrations and you don't have any enforcement costs, and then you don't do any blocking. And if you do blocking, then you don't have any direct costs or enforcement costs. And if you do enforcement, then it's because you didn't do these other things. In which case, each of those would be, we'd have to consider each of those buckets entirely separately and see what the net cost of the program was. My intuition is that's not the case, and that what we'll actually see is these same brands that are registering defensively quite aggressively are also bearing most of the blocking costs and probably most of the enforcement costs as well. But it'd be good to actually substantiate that with data as opposed to intuition.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, I think your other point before when you're saying, you know, and I agree with that, defensive registration costs are certainly a cost to the program, and it's not something we want to see. Nobody really wants it. The whole idea is innovation. So if you just got defensive in there and it's not being used, then there's no real benefit to that. And I think if we look at the 25 million domain names, that's where we could have a very broad conclusion. If we saw that 20 million of these were defensive registrations by brands, we would have an incredibly different conclusion. And thank goodness it's not, because that would be a nightmare if that was the situation, that we had that much by brands defensive registering. It would sort of squeeze out any decent innovation, et cetera. So it's, but as I say, it's trying to get that big picture, which is a hard thing to get. But
Yeah, thanks, David. That's a good point. I do feel confident from the data that we've seen so far that like you say, thank goodness it's not, that actually the defensive registrations seem to be a relatively small fraction of, at least by trademark purposes in particular, seem to be a relatively small fraction of the, or quite small fraction of the overall registrations. We only have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to go back to Kylie, who's put his hand up in the queue, and then we're going to have to wrap this up and turn it back to Lorraine. So Kylie, go ahead. You've got just about a minute before we need to wrap things up. We can't hear you, Kylie.
Are you able to hear me?
Oh, there we go. Yeah, go ahead, Kylie. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, great. I just want to echo David's point. Well, if we just look at defective registration alone, that might be a small problem. So if we put them together, look at with parking together, we have millions and millions of park registration. And if we do not install any mechanism, I believe it's to stop the hijacking of brand names in the city level domain, it's only going to be a matter of time that you and David mentioned what happened. That is a force, hundreds or maybe even thousands of game owners to rush to for defensive registration. So therefore, I believe that we look at this problem and we could recommend further study in future review. I don't think that is any harm to us, and obviously will be part of our contribution, our review team's contribution to ICANN and all the stakeholders. And also that, I still have to comment, even if it's not that serious problem.
Yeah, thanks, Kylie. I do think it is definitely the case that one of the problems, we don't have any trend data here at all, in that we don't see, we know what the current defensive behavior looks like from the analysis group TMCH report. Don't know if that's increasing or decreasing. over time. So that might be a good example of something where ongoing data collection would be useful. So we'll try to capture that recommendation as well.
Yeah, I would say, even though we do not have any data to show that it's a very significant problem. However, now it's our data already show that it occurs, even if currently the scale is not that great. So I would still suggest that we include this point in our final report and at least caution them, because this is the situation could escalate in the future. And also, if some medicine is super steady, that at least shows that we have done our job. And then, so provide as much inheritance to the next review as possible. That is what I see, or what I believe the right thing to do.
Okay, thanks, Kylie. We're going to have to give you the last word for now on that because we're now over time. But we'll try to incorporate that into some of the discussion going forward. And we are waiting for some additional study from INTA in particular. But I'm going to turn things over to Laureen at this point because we're going to go through and take a look at the recommendations from the safeguards and trust side. So, Laureen, it's over to you. Hopefully. I see Laureen on the call, but don't seem to be having luck with audio here. Okay, I'll stall for a minute.
Sorry, sure. My fault.
Oh, there you go.
Sorry, apologies. I'm talking and there's silence. It's like, why can't anyone hear me? Unfortunately, though, now my Adobe Connect has as soon as one communication method worked, another communication method. Okay, now I'm back. Okay, firing on all cylinders now. I thought we could stick with the IP issues since we have the benefit of David with us, and that David, perhaps we can walk through your papers and work through recommendations and the template that we had discussed on the last plenary call, and also that I had sent out to my subgroup via email. David, is that something that you're comfortable with? Yes?
I don't have anything in front of me, and I haven't looked at them since I wrote them. But if that helps, I'm quite happy to read them at the same time as you and hopefully remember the synopsis.
Okay.
So you'll have to share them with me because I don't have access where I'm standing at the moment to them.
Okay. So
it might
so
be
are
the best
you,
way.
Okay. So you are want, you? Is that what? So just to translate, does that mean you don't have access to a screen? Is that what you're saying?
No, I do. I have Adobe now. I can see it in Adobe.
Okay.
So
good.
So I can see that. Yeah. But
perfect.
As I said, this was 20 days ago, so I'm trying to remember what I was going through. So, okay, let's go through them. I can run through these, I'm sure. Do I have scrolling rights on it?
Yes, we can just give everyone independent scrolling.
I seem to have, yeah. Okay, so I can do that. I need to make it a little bit bigger because I'm getting short-sighted as my age gets on. There we go. I think I can see that. Good. Right. I do like the way one thing there you said, Dave. I like the way you said that you have the benefit of me on this call and just with the discussion.
you heard how I slid that right in there, didn't you?
Yeah, but I did. But for another reason which you might not be thinking, I particularly like the benefit of me rather than the cost of me, you see, because it's the cost of rights protections, the cost of it. For once, I'm a benefit, so I like that.
You're absolutely a benefit.
So, yeah, so this was the first question we had, was the new GFTLD program has put the mechanisms in place and putting a description of the RPMs there. So there I've gone through and basically run through a little bit of the background and the history of it, because we've got the UDRP, which existed and has existed since 1999, but we had the Mexico meeting, ICANN meeting, and prior to that, where there was quite a bit of consternation from the brand community saying that the UDRP would not be sufficient to deal with a flood of new GTLDs, which at the time, I think their figure was 500 at the most, but it would still be a flood, and the UDRP, you know, just wouldn't cope with that, and it wasn't fast enough, and the whole process had evolved. So that was putting in the background there. The IRT, which was formed by a board resolution back in 2009, and that's the one I sat on back then with 17 other people, which created and set up the clearinghouse, the uniform rapid suspension, as we know, and also the PDDRP for taking out a TLD that does something bad. So that was that. And also then there was a specific process, as I covered, string confusion, objections, limited community and legal rights, which I'm going to put those, and I haven't finished that yet, but I was working on that. Coming back from India, so I'll add something into that. You've then got the description of the UDRP, which I probably don't need to go through, detailed description of the URS, so we can see all of what goes on in there, and then the PDDRP, and what's going on there, and the various sort of sub-branches, I'll call it, of the PDDRP. So that was all of the various mechanisms, and then finishing up with the clearinghouse. And there at the end, you'll see there, which I want to complete, is the description of the objection processes. So hopefully there's quite a bit of material there we can obviously use in the draft stroke final report as we wish. But that's what I was trying to pull together, so we've got the background. That's where I am on that. Happy to take any questions, but it's nothing groundbreaking on there, I think.
And so, David, this is basically more of a description of what's in place, yeah?
Yes, yeah.
That was what we were. So would any recommendations flow from this, or is this more background?
I think it's really background. I can't think of recommendations. It's only when we start to look at how they've been used, whether we can get to a recommendation. You know, I think that's where it ties in with what Megan's been looking at, you know, with the string confusion objection, for instance, mm-hmm. whether the you know, that's why I need to put in sort of the description of it, so we know what the string confusion objection is. We've got that background, and then from there we can see, well, was it used successfully or not? Was the community objections used successfully or not? Did the legal rights objections, were they used successfully or not? And that's, you know, an area which obviously we need to fluff out and develop.
Right.
And that's where we
get
the recommendations.
Right. Okay. So in terms of timing, we're trying to pound out a draft next week. So to the mm-hmm. extent that you can finish the background here that needs to be done
yeah.
sooner rather than later,
I will undertake, and lawyers can't give undertakings unless they actually do them. So it's much better than saying I will try to. I will undertake to have the description of the objections to you by the end of this week.
Perfect. Thank you. So should we move on then to the next paper, which I think
sure.
I think your other papers do have material that leads to
got a little bit more in, yeah. Yeah. I should have swatted up and read these before the call again. So I'm waiting to discover, because I can't remember. I do too many things. What is this going to say? What did I say in it?
It's an adventure for all of us.
It is. Here we go. What's this one? Have the new GTLD operators complied with the RPMs? Oh, this was the simple one, I think. I don't have scrolling rights yet to see if there's anything underneath it, but I don't think there is. So
I don't think there is.
Nah. So whether there's any issues arising with non-compliance and the GTLD operators, so that's, I know I put there my findings there. In essence, it seems that they've complied with their obligations under the registry agreement, and they're put to locate any examples of non-compliance. I haven't seen any examples of non-compliance in my searching, but there again, I could well be missing it. So I don't know if Elisa's got that. That was part of the, which I think you did say in Hyderabad, that you had replied to me, so I probably missed that email. You can pull that to my attention again. I'll look at it, but it was the section on the ICANN website which had the complaints, and I'd asked what were the complaints about. So if we've got that answer and there's complaints in there which are talking about registries not complying, then obviously we can build those into here. But I haven't looked through that if there is data. So if there is data there, please do point it and I'll start sifting through that to see. But I haven't seen any non-compliance by registries.
So maybe you can touch base with Aliza to
yep.
make sure you're on the same page regarding the data that's available.
Will do. Okay.
Okay, and I also see the mention here. Is there, and I think that one thing that may flow from this, depending on what you find in terms of data, David, is if you can't tell from the compliance information, if the information isn't granular enough, a recommendation that might flow is for more granular information to be available in terms of the compliance information that is,
yep.
you know, public-facing.
Yeah.
Because we've seen that in other areas. So that's something to consider, you know, whether the data is sufficiently transparent and specific to be able to identify the subject matter of the complaint. Okay, so Elise is asking you to follow up with her. Okay.
Okay.
In the notes. Okay. Then should we move on to your next paper?
Yep. I think there's two more, isn't there?
I believe so.
So this was the, did the RPMs help mitigate certain risks?
Right, this was the Meteor paper.
Yeah. So this one, sorry, I'm just going to skim through it so I can recall. Okay, yeah, rings bells. So this was a bunch of sub-questions, which is what, getting an echo. A bunch of sub-questions. Oh, is anyone else getting that echo? I'm getting a high echo suddenly in my ears.
I'm getting an echo too. Is everyone on mute?
Well, I'm not. I know I'm not. Oh, the mute's gone. It's gone. The mute's there. Sorry. The echo's gone. So, yes, there was a bunch of sub-questions in here, which were the sub-questions which we ran through. I can't remember exactly when we did run through them, but a little while ago, prior to India. So it was basically trying to get a bunch of questions together. And then I went through some of the findings here as well. Pull these findings. This was from the reports which are available on the ICANN website. So it was limited specifically to that. And I think there we've got, there's quite a bit more data. So I was looking at that the other day. So, I mean, if we do look at it there, the number of cases filed UDRP in URSs, it does seem that there hasn't, you know, that the number of UDRPs seem to have dropped slightly. That's taking 2012 as a baseline, which is what I did because that's what was within, the ICANN sort of data. But obviously the funny thing or the interesting thing is 2012 was also a peak year. So if you go back and look at the UDRP over the 10 years previous, 2012 was the largest year ever of disputes. So, again, you can change your data because all I need to do is take a baseline of 2008 or 10. And then we've got an increase, but the bottom line is we're not seeing, as far as I'm concerned, and that's the key point, we're not seeing triple number of UDRPs being filed. So that's the main point that comes out of that. But I think that's the finer points, which is what I've built into the presentation, because if you drill down and look at some of WIPO's data, et cetera, you see that there's actually quite a significant proportion of their cases involving new GTLDs. And if you hence look at that, you can see it. I can't remember the stats there because it's not in this. I've got it somewhere else. It was in the presentation, I think. But you're looking at something where there's a higher proportion of cases involving new GTLDs than the number of registrations that are out there when you look at the percentage of every 25 million. So again, we can look at this and come at it from various angles, and I think that's the way I'm trying to do it, is look at it from the various angles and see what we can conclude, and more to the point, what we can conclude with any certainty, because data can be shown to show anything, which I don't really want to be doing. I want to try and get an objective view. And so there we've got the complaints, number two there, complaints to ICANN concerning importation of UDRP URFs. Let's pass on that, because that's the bit we need to go through with, I need to go through with Elisa. And the registry restrictions dispute to resolution procedure at number three, there's been no cases, so not much data there. And then we've got share of Sunrise registrations, domain name blocks to total registrations. There we've got some data, so that's on my to-do list to be looking through that sort of data and see what we can find. And I think just reminds me, if I go back to the URS UDRP point, which I thought the data was in there with number of URS cases. Oh, there, sorry, yes. I've got my little hand hovering over it there. The number of URS complaints. No, that's not it, sorry. It was this bit, yes. The URS complaints, 229 in 2014, 220 in 2015. I mean, according to my stats, when I went onto the forum website, for instance, I think we're looking at over 600 complaints. So we've actually got quite a bit. There's a third more than is in this data, so I'm not sure whether the data is fully correct. I need to cross-reference that and whether we're looking at the same cases. From that, it was saying, you know, we were looking at 400 odd cases, and it seems to be quite a bit more. So it's maybe showing that there's a lot more in 2016. Again, we need to look at that data, which is on my to-do list. The real fact there, I think, is what we can all agree on is that there's not as many cases as many of us thought there would be on URS. I mean, it's a surprisingly low number. And again, what you can conclude from that is various things. It can be that it's such a wonderful mechanism that everyone is so scared of the fact that it exists that no one is registering, and the bad guys are not doing the bad things, which is why everyone's very happy. And URS is not being used very much, or it could be that the process is so diabolically developed that nobody likes it and it's such a pain to use that no one's using it, and they're just letting the abuse run rampant. So you can conclude many things. So again, we have to try and look at that and see a lot of the anecdotal evidence around it. And again, hopefully the INTA, where brand owners will be coming in and saying why they're using it, why they're not using it, what issues they've had with it. And again, we can drill down into that because there's been a lot of discussion about various URS cases and the issues. So I'll put something together on that. I'll try and do it high level, but that's, you know, that's sort of a very detailed article or more to be going through and starting to go into that. So again, difficult to know how much to go into in the time available. I don't think I'll be promising anything like that to you, Maureen, for the end of this week, but it's certainly something which, as I've got time, I will try and look into and build something together on that. And I don't think there's anything else to say on this one, apart from, I did have some recommendations. Yes,
and that's what I'd really like to focus on. I appreciate you giving us the overview, though, because we haven't had a chance to hear that yet. I think Jordan has his hand up.
Okay, go.
Yeah, David, were you going to run through the recommendations first? Because I'm fine waiting. I just have a couple general observations, so I'm fine to wait till after the review of the recommendations.
Okay, sure. Priority, yes, to have a full impact study to inform the community. That's obviously the INTA study, and it's just hoping that we're not going to have the results of that for this preliminary report, but all guns are going for it to be ready for the final report, so that we will have. So we're going to have to put quite a few placeholders in, because that's going to bring in a large amount of data, I think, for us to look at. So our work will be cut out, I think, more in the sort of February, March, April time than it is just now, because otherwise we'll perhaps falsely conclude. Recommendations there, number one, that's what I've just mentioned. I was thinking that this impact study is something which we should be repeating at regular intervals so that we can see the evolution once we've got the questions, once we've got there, like we've seen with the Nielsen, where you can go back and do a similar query 18, 24 months later. We're going to get the data and we're going to see the evolution for future groups looking at this, future review teams. I think we need to consider the relationship between the URS and the UDRP. That's something there's quite a bit of commentary on, and I think it is something which needs to be flagged as a recommendation that it is considered, and I think it will be considered. You know, and that's basically talking about do you have the two living in parallel? Do you have one that's a precursor to the other? You know, as an anecdote, I find it very time consuming to be talking to clients, explaining to them the difference between the court action, the UDRP, the URS, or anything. And like that, oh, I've got someone's come off mute. I'm hearing myself again loudly. And I think that's one of the biggest problems, that you can spend. I can't hear myself. Whoever's on off mute. Good. Thanks. I think that's one of the biggest things when you look at costs. The actual cost of filing URS is very small, and a UDRP is not a lot more when you compare to court action. But if you're talking to lawyers, you kind of figure out what's going on and what the difference is between all of these things. You can easily spend way more cost than the cost of filing URS, being told whether or not you should file the URS, or whether you should file UDRP, or whether you should go to court, or whether you should do this, or whether you should, you know, and that's sort of, to me, the big issue. So anything we can do to simplify things for brand owners and registrants alike, I think is good. And I think the URS, to me, is rather complex as it stands.
So just to jump in here a minute, David, because I want to use this to sort of illustrate. So these are recommendations that are in, I'll say they're early stages, but I want to make sure that you and everyone else understands that that these, consistent with my email earlier this week, these really need to be put in a much more precise and fulsome format, because otherwise they're not going to be useful for our preliminary report. And my drafts are similarly challenged when I use words like consider, and when I don't tie it to the findings. But I just want to. What I want to emphasize to you and everyone else on the call is that what I've asked everyone to do within our sub-team is to reformulate these recommendations. So first of all, they relate to the findings, and they are phrased in given the findings of X, and for you it may tie to the complexity of certain procedures, or the lack of sufficient information about certain procedures. But a consider the relationship isn't specific enough to be useful. So we need to tie it to the findings, and you need to make an actual recommendation. Which perhaps might be, I don't know what your recommendation is because you're the expert on it, not me, but I can't tell what your recommendation is in this sentence, and that's what I'm getting at.
Your
recommendation one thing is too complex or too costly, or that there are certain challenges, or that a survey should be done to see why this is or isn't used. It just needs to be more specific, and it also needs to be directed to an entity within the ICANN ecosystem who should be considering this. What entity is it? The board? Is it staff? Is it a PDP process? Is it budget for a future review team to do more data gathering. So it needs to have that level of precision. Otherwise, it's not going to be a useful recommendation. I just want to make sure that you're the person I'm pouncing on this week. Last week, Calvin was the person pounced upon, so I'm an equal opportunity pouncer. But I want to make sure that everyone understands that, because at the end of the day, what people are going to be looking at most of all
are our recommendations, and they need to have that level of precision. It needs to be, given the findings about the costliness of this procedure, we recommend that I can look into methodology to decrease the cost, or you know, whatever it is. But it has to tie to the findings. It has to be a precise action, and it has to be directed to an entity within the ICANN ecosystem. And then the other thing that Jonathan has emphasized is we should be prioritizing this. Is this a short term, you know, midterm, long term? You know, where does it fit in? So I just want to use this as an illustration of how we need to be moving along within these draft recommendations.
No, and
that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That does make sense. And I think this is really a good case and a good example of a chicken and egg. Because I think if I make recommendations based on the data we have, I'll stop at number two.
Mm-hmm.
And I can make that precise because we don't have the findings, we don't have the data to look at. So, you know, something like consider the relationship between the URS and the UDRP, that is a recommendation, you know, almost based on David Taylor having helped create the URS, watched it develop through the entire process, and now seen it used by close to 20 or 30 clients and had many, many client calls, et cetera, on it, and got sick to death of trying to explain the different burden between the URS and UDRP and which one should be used and which one is that, and that's why this one failed, et cetera. That is a conclusion which I can draw and a recommendation which I have. Do I have the data? I could put a wonderful paper together on it, and I could delve into the RPM working group and find stuff, and I'm sure we could put something together, but that in itself would probably take me a couple of days to get to recommendation number three. So really, I'm in this point, I was trying to sort of flag where I think this would go, that there would be a general consensus that this is something which is an important thing to do, and I wouldn't get much kickback. I don't think many people would be saying, oh, no, there's no relationship with the URS and EDRP. They should be looked entirely separately, et cetera. So I, you know, I'm trying to pick out something which is, I'm trying to make a recommendation which is objective without having the data available to make that recommendation. So, you know, when we get into a sort of report stage, I would hope something like this is in the final report, and I hope we've got data to prove it. And if we haven't got any data or anything, then we have to drop it. So really, I'm sort of flagging these, so I was trying to get a direction to go in where I think we would be finding ourselves, if you see what I mean.
That makes sense. So what I would say is, if there is an efficient way to incorporate that data into your report, other than spending a few days on a whole separate paper, which I think, at least at this point in time, doesn't seem realistic, I would say if there's an efficient way to incorporate this data into your paper, do so. But in the absence of data, then I think we need to drop the recommendation. I know you know far more than is reflected in your papers, but we need to create a system where our recommendations flow from our data, not from all the things that, of course, we know from our experience as well. You know, I leave it to you to find that balance. But for everyone, if you don't have data, we shouldn't be making recommendations.
I think I just to add to that again, it's to me, you've got to remember, it's because we're working parallel and doing so many things together. You know, we're trying to get recommendations from findings from data, and it's the chicken and egg. We don't have the data, so without having the data, we're swimming around, but it's also because I'm obviously spending a fair bit of time trying to get the data. So hence a recommendation there, you know, consider the relationship between the URS and the UDRP. That is trying to format, in a way, some of the questions which we're asking brand owners so we get the data. So, yes, mm-hmm. in a way, you could argue I'm going around this in a reverse manner, but it's not really that. It's, you know, it's more the fact of we're trying to do it simultaneously. So if we don't have those questions, we're never going to get any recommendation as to whether we should consider or shouldn't consider the relationship, whether there should be a transfer or whether there shouldn't be a transfer. So
right.
Again,
and I'm not saying don't collect the data, or
yeah, yeah.
have a placeholder to say we're gathering data on this and it may lead to a recommendation. I'm just saying for this preliminary report, we either need to have recommendations flowing from data or have a placeholder to say we're gathering this data. We don't have it yet, but once we do, we suspect a recommendation will flow out of it. So we certainly need to have placeholders. That is not a problem. We will all have placeholders.
Good. Now, that makes sense. That's what really it is. That's why I caveated with a big draft above it. I'm trying to get a placeholder in there so we know where we're going. So don't misread this. As you look at that, I agree. I mean, number eight, consider the usefulness of Donut's DPML and the DPML Plus. You know, that we haven't got any data. So is it useful? Isn't it useful? To me, that is a key recommendation we want to be looking at. Whether it was useful, whether this was a good practice, a bad practice, should other registries do this, should they not do this, except and all those questions grow out of it. And unless someone's asking those questions, and I remember when we were doing the Nielsen survey, we were putting in questions there because we were brainstorming sort of 15 of us around the table saying we should put this question and this question. We're at that stage with whoever is the provider to do the questionnaire. We're going to have to make sure we get the right questions in there and work with them so that we can try and ascertain some recommendations out of it. So, again, that's really why I'm putting that in there. And it's nebulous the way I've put it as a recommendation. It's sort of, here's a recommendation of the data we need to collect, I should be perhaps rephrasing it as.
Right, which would be fine. A recommendation to collect data is fine, especially if, we're not able to make the recommendations we might like to because we don't have sufficient information. So it's perfectly fine to say that, but I think what needs to be needed is we looked for this, but at this point we did not have this.
Yeah. I'll try and make something suitable.
Are the other recommendations more in this category where they're flagging information that you'd like to have, or are there any that that flow from the data that we actually have?
Rather than things which they like to have, the sort of things which we should consider. I suppose that's why it's probably appropriate that I put consider there again, picking up just the noise which a lot of people on this group may or may not hear, but you know, there are a lot of people who say there should be a loser pay model, and there's a lot of people who say there shouldn't be a loser pay model, and there's arguments both ways, and I don't necessarily hold either view on that, but I think we need data to understand whether a loser pay model would be detrimental to registrants in an untoward way and hence should not be considered, or whether it is something which would deter abuse in the system and hence be a good thing for the new GTLD process going forward. And that really depends which side of the fence you're sitting on as to which you agree on. So again, that's something which we wouldn't have a conclusion on that as to whether or not it should happen. But that's why I think, you know, the recommendations, I was kind of going there thinking, well, if you ask brand owners, I'm sure 80% of them will say yes, let's have a loser pay model. So that's where the INTA survey wouldn't necessarily help on this particular point. But I think it is, for me, something which is more general as us as a group, where we might be making recommendations. Now, I don't know how we bring those in without specific data, and maybe we can't. But to me, it's something which, you know, ICANN should consider this and carry out a proper survey of it and get a clear understanding of the pros and cons of it and decide whether it's something which should be put in place or discarded, for instance. So again, that's, you know, there, you know, and then the applicability of new GTLD RPM to legacy TLDs. Do we want an even playing field? This comes onto the competition side, because where they don't apply, is that an unfair playing field? How does that tie in? So again, I'm really flagging it as recommendations of something, well, we need to be considering this. How do we consider it and how do we go about doing it? So that's just really the background on it, you know, in these ones. So I'm really highlighting things which I know are topics of discussion. And there's a lot of viewpoints on it, and I don't know whether we can get data and this sort of thing, but we need to try.
Right. And I guess my main point is that we can't introduce things in the recommendations. I mean, just like in a legal brief, you have to have things and you have to have your first section is always going to be facts, and then you can make an argument based on those facts. But we can't go straight to our argument here and make recommendations when we haven't teed it up with facts or data. So to the extent you want to have these recommendations, there has to be some sort of discussion about them to tee it up.
Absolutely,
and I think
I think that's the exactly with the loser pays model, for instance, is a good one. I'm sure we will have data in February or March where a significant number of brands, as per the survey, think that a loser pay model is a good idea. So what do you do with that? So we, our recommendation would be, you know, I don't think I'd go as far as to say a loser pay model should be put into place, or whether we say a large proportion of brands think this. To my, to me, the conclusion is, well, that's the brand side of things, so let's be objective about this. They're going to want the loser pay model, so that's not really a, you know, it's a no-brainer because it's in their advantage. So ICANN needs to, you know, how do they go through this process of dealing with it? And how do we get something in place which is fair to all and fair to, and that, that's the point really. So again, I think it's, these will be interesting because it'll depend how we phrase them. But you know, that, that's my point. I think there that it's going to be clear we're going to have that as a recommendation to consider. To me, that would be considerate. So again, I'm jumping ahead because I'm guessing that's what the results of a survey would be, because I just cannot imagine brand owners saying, oh no, we don't want registrants to pay any money towards this if they've abused our brand.
And what I would say would be a more useful formulation of the recommendation, just for illustrative purposes, and feel free to push back, I would say instead of consider, which I've used the same thing, but it's wishy-washy, it's mushy, I would say, given the survey results, which indicate brand owners would prefer a loser pay model, ICANN should assess the costs and benefits of such a model, not only to brand owners, but to, and I don't know who the other players are, but you know, I would phrase it in that neutral way, and I would tie it to the findings, and I wouldn't say consider, I would say assess the costs and benefits, because that's much more precise and useful. Someone
absolutely,
can actually do something with that. I can consider things till the cows come home, but assessing costs and benefits, that's going to be something useful.
Absolutely,
does that, does that make sense? So, again, I'm using to illustrate to everyone how we need to be phrasing these recommendations.
And as I said, I think that comes back to, just to finish on that, so it comes back, I agree completely that that's the sort of recommendation. If we had the data, it would be something like that. We don't have the data, so I certainly can't write that now. So as I say, I would probably step up recommendations at number two would be the last recommendation on there, and there'll be a placeholder for these other areas which we think, I don't know how I'd write that, but I would, there would be other areas we think will need consideration once we've had sufficient data, and leave it like that.
I think that's fine. I think that's fine because we don't want to lose the good thoughts you have based on your knowledge of this area and the hot spots. So I think putting placeholders there is fine. But for the things we do have data on, we just need to be precise. And I'm mindful of the time. I think we have about 7 more minutes, and I know you have 2 hands up in the queue, so maybe we should take questions and then see what else we have time for.
Sure.
So I think, Jordan, your hand was up first, and it looks like Megan has taken her hand down.
Sure. So, it's Jordan. I'll just jump in. So a couple quick thoughts. The first I put in the chat already, I think in the initial findings sections, it would be really helpful to figure out ways to normalize this data somewhat. And so for the case of the numbers of UDRP and URX cases, it may be helpful. You know, David, you pointed out that it, depending on where your baseline year is,
you may see sort of like different trends. I think one thing that would be helpful for me to understand is how the number of cases relate to like the total number of domain registrations, because presumably, you know, those are increasing over time as well. And so making some attempt to say like, oh, you know, there were 3,987 UDRPs, and there, at the time there were N million registrations subject to the UDRP, and so the rate is whatever, 3.7 per 1 million registrations or something like that, would be helpful just to sort of see how if in 2008 there were way fewer domain registrations and that's the reason why there were fewer UDRP cases, we may still see an overall positive trend or negative trend, but I think that would be a helpful bit of normalization. And similarly, I think that with the number of UDRP and URS cases, URS complaints, relating those to the total number of cases would be helpful as well, just to see sort of like what the fraction of cases that are generating complaints looks like. You know, that might allow us to make some sort of useful, because I see, for example, that from 2014 to 2015, we see, a 35% increase in complaints, whereas the UDRP complaints are decreasing. But this might just be a result of the fact that there's a lot more, you know, in 2014, maybe there were very few URS cases, and it's the first year, maybe people are terrible at implementing it. Whereas in 2015, maybe there's 10 times as many cases, even though there's a few more complaints, and so actually we've gotten much better at implementing it. So I think some amount of just sort of thinking about ways to normalize some of these numbers or give us some basis to compare them would be helpful, would be my first observation. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, Lorraine's covered most of my thoughts on recommendations, but I think, you know, when I look at these recommendations, I think some of them strike me as just things that we should be doing ourselves, so it's really like recommendation to the CCTRT. So like the relationship between the URS and the UDRP, that's I think something that we would want to get to the bottom of and then maybe come up with our own recommendations about what to do after we think about it some more. Some of these other later ones about the applicability of new GTLDs to legacy TLDs, when Maureen talked about audience, I think in some cases we may just want to say these are important issues, but we know, for example, that there's either the subsequent procedures PDP or the RPM review, not the RPM review, the RPM PDP, and these may just be questions that we want to make sure that we tee up for those other processes. And so I think just thinking about, in each of the cases, these recommendations, is there some other body that's actually probably the best place to be considering them, would be helpful as well.
Mm. Yep, good points. Thanks.
David, did you have one last paper?
Yeah, I think I did four, so there should be a fourth one. I don't think it was copious. I can't recall. Which is probably good in the fact we haven't got much time left.
Are staff able to locate that? Not sure that they are, judging by was too soon.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is
no, that's the first one again.
That's the first one. Okay, you know what?
Doesn't matter. Let's move on. Because,
because our time is short. But I think it and we're having trouble locating the paper. I think what we should do is, I know that we have a couple of other agenda items, data requests, listing, which I think Alisa was probably going to lead, and then the draft report structure and next steps. And I do want to leave time for that since our time is short. So, Alisa, would it make sense now for me to turn the floor over to you?
Hi, Lorraine. Sure. I wasn't sure if you guys wanted me to get through this. Can we... There we go. Here's the list. So I wanted to talk a little bit about data request prioritization. We've gotten a number of different requests that are still outstanding to analysis group, and altogether they will add on to the cost that we have for our work with analysis group. It's going outside of the scope of what we had originally anticipated for them and had added on to their to the scope of work that they agreed to conduct for the competition subteam. So we wanted to go through this list with you all to see if we could prioritize the projects that are outstanding, see which ones you'd like to receive first, or if there are any that perhaps aren't as critical for either your draft report or could be deferred to future, to either a future report or a future review. So I see that Jordan has his hand raised, and these primarily come from the competition team. Maybe you can walk through these.
Well, so what I was actually going to say is I actually think we need Stan's. I think a lot of these requests came from Stan. It doesn't look like he made the call today. I did raise this with him over email, but I would suggest that we actually just defer this conversation or just move it to email because I think we're going to need Stan's feedback for it to be meaningful.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, and also because this is really something that it seems like the competition subteam needs to work through. It might be a better sub-team activity via email or a separate phone call.
Yeah, that's right. I had suggested yesterday that we have the discussion on this call just for a time, just because we were all going to be together. But I agree with Laureen that it's better suited for the competition sub-team. So, Aliza, let's just sync offline and see what the best way to, like, take this up is. I do think we want to make sure that we figure which of these are really necessary. I think some of the ones that are related to price, for example, we don't have any way of getting at other than with analysis group, but some of the other ones we may be able to either compute separately or they'll be less critical to the report. So I think we should probably just figure out the right venue to have the conversation, and I'll take back my suggestion from yesterday of doing it today just because we don't have quite the right audience here.
Okay, that's fine. Just a note that we'd want to make a decision on this fairly quickly. Obviously, you won't have this in time for your drafting session.
Great.
So I think that'll take us to the draft report structure and next steps. Who is leading that discussion?
Laureen, this is Margie. I can quickly walk us through what's going to happen. As we mentioned, several of us will be in Washington, D.C. next week to try to pull together the draft report. And I imagine that at the end of that, we'll be circulating the draft for input from the rest of the team. We're tentatively scheduling plenary calls, not next week, but the week after, in anticipation that there might be a need for discussion. And if we're able to do it through email, you know, maybe we'll cancel those, but we at least put them out there until we know whether we need them. And with regard to the timing of the plenary calls, we're going to push them up 1 hour, so they're a little bit later, or push them back an hour, I guess, because of the time change in the U.S. It makes it extremely early for the West Coast folks. So all the plenary calls that take place from here on out will be an hour later than today's call. Do we have, Jean-Baptiste, do we have the format of the structure that we used in the past for the report that we could at least show the group, or is that not available to post on the website, I mean on the Adobe Connect? The one that Alice had done, I think she'd posted it on the wiki at some point. So this, what you see on the Adobe Connect room is the draft report that Alice had provided a shelf for the discussion, and it's set to scroll so you can scroll through it. Essentially, it follows the format that was used with the reports that were generated related to the IANA transition that the CCWG groups had pulled together. What we did as staff was provide some details on just the background sections to help facilitate the drafting of the document. And then for the folks that are coming to D.C., this is certainly a format we can talk about to see whether it needs to be refined, but I at least wanted to give you guys a heads up as to what Alice had suggested from several months ago. And with that, any questions?
I have a question about...
The other thing we're going to do is, because this was drafted by Alice before we had some findings, some studies that came in, such as the phase two from analysis group and then some of the Nielsen work, Jean-Baptiste is going to take the next few days over the holiday to fill in the details in some of the appendices as to the findings from those reports. So that the report will at least summarize some of the recent studies and data findings. So that's all I had, Lori.
Margie, I had a question with metrics. It says analysis of recommendation implementation, assessment. I don't see how these even relate to what we're doing.
Where are you looking?
I'm looking at page 8.
Recommendations.
Or page 7. I don't even understand that.
Yeah, this is, as I mentioned, Alice had just done this a while ago before we did some of the, you guys did the work related to all the templates. So I think probably one of the first things we'll do in D.C. is identify how we want to structure each of the sections so we're consistent and track what was done by the sub-teams. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I'm thinking even now some work could be done maybe to make this a little more, to make this match a little more of the efforts that have already been done.
Sure, we can take that back and have Jean-Baptiste go back to the templates that have been used recently and try to track that so that it makes it easier for us when we get to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think that would probably make sense.
Jordan?
It's Jordan. I was just going to suggest, I'm a little worried that we'll get too attached to the templates and lose track of the overall narrative. Flow. I think I'm not 100% sure how to approach that, but I think, I mean, we can have Jean-Baptiste do it as a first cut, but I suspect the right thing to do is probably when we first get together in D.C. is just think about overall structure and story and whether we want to, you know, I think breaking it down by the high-level questions is probably the right approach, but within that, I think there's going to be quite a bit of narrative that's not necessarily going to, that's going to have to necessarily pull together some of the individual papers and structure that we have so far. Like just even today, at least on the competition side, when we were talking about the structure of the findings doc, there's places where we probably want to sort of weave together a few different sections. And so I wouldn't spend too much time on the structure going in, other than just to flag all the stuff that we have researched, and then we can spend a little bit of time up front thinking about how we want to look at that, right? The other thing I think that is inevitably going to be true is as we start writing, it'll become a lot more obvious what the structure is supposed to be like than if we try to build the structure too much in advance, because it's like war plans. They're great until the first shot's fired.
Yeah, Sure, that makes a lot of sense. All right, so that's the report structure. Any other business? Okay, well, hearing none, thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving for those of you in the U.S., and some of us will see you next week in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, all.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.